Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Mike Inman. Mike is a senior partner at Tableforce and negotiationtraining.com. He is the former head of procurement for MGM Resorts International and American Airlines, among others. He's a man who has spent his career on both sides of the negotiation table as both a buyer and a seller, and he has trained thousands of professional negotiators along the way. And today I'm really excited for our conversation as it takes multiple twists and turns and covers many different opportunities throughout the negotiation process. Opportunities like, what are some very real techniques for building confidence? How do buyers and sellers apply negotiation techniques differently? Why it's so important to continue adding tools to your tool belt, and why it's also important to stop and consider at times, what am I asking for in return? It's a great and energetic conversation. I'm really appreciative for Mike taking the time, and I'm very happy to share it all with you today. Thank you for being here. Of course, before we go further, we do want to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, HumanTel. Oftentimes we get asked, how do you understand what somebody was thinking in that moment? Well, if you take training like HumanTel's, you can understand what people are likely thinking and feeling at any point in time by registering when their emotions are changing and evaluating that within the context of the situation. And you can often pick that up based on their facial expressions and nonverbal behavior. You can learn how to do this and more with HumanTel's best-in-class online training at humantel.com. And when you choose the program that's right for you, please enter the code INCOISIVE25 for 25% off of all of their online training. Check it out at humantel.com. Please also, for the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can see all of the resources that the International Association of Interviewers has for professional interviewers. Online training, in-person training, interview resources, legal updates and resources, community and networking opportunities. And of course, that's where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? What does it take to pass the exam? And then once you have, what that can mean for you in your career. All of that and more over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And please, while you're online, head over to incoisive.com. That's where you can learn about the programs that our clients ask us to facilitate for them, for their leadership teams, for their sales teams, and for their negotiation teams, to teach them how to apply strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques to encourage people to share their everyday confessions across the scope of their daily conversations. All that and more can be found at incoisive.com. Thank you all so much for taking the time to be here today. We truly appreciate it. So without further ado, Mike Inman. Good morning, Mike. It is great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Hey, Mike, thank you for having me. And I'm starting my day off fantastic. It's Denver, Colorado. It's going to be 75 degrees and the sun is out. So, all's good for right now.
Well, with a day like that out in Denver, hopefully as soon as we're done, you get a chance to get outside and enjoy it.
I do have a beach volleyball match scheduled for later today.
Trying to think of the closest beach to Denver, but I don't have that kind of brain power.
Sand, sorry. Shouldn't say beach, sand. Yeah.
There you go. It's a long walk to California.
Yes, it is.
I'm really excited to have you on. And the concept of the conversation around negotiation could go a million different ways. And we could probably spend well over an hour talking about each individual aspect from multiple perspectives. So I'm really just excited to see where this conversation takes us. So in just learning a little bit about your experience, your background as a practitioner, your background as an educator, of course, where they overlap. What I would love to do is start just with a broad question and then just run with the conversation from there. So in your experience as both a practitioner and an educator, what have you found to be, if not the, several of the most reliable or impactful negotiation techniques that help lead to successful agreements?
That's a great question. I'm going to lead with something that's going to sound kind of silly, actually. People need to try to negotiate more. And what that means is we see life as kind of a binary choice, take it or leave it. At the retail store, you see a price, you decide to buy it or not. When you go check into a restaurant, Do you want the bar or the restaurant? Do you want the high top? Do you want the booth? And you accept it. So there's all these opportunities to negotiate that we miss because we're not really paying attention to what's out there and what we could do for each other. In B2B negotiations, which is where I kind of specialize within the broad sense of negotiating, I'll see this a lot. Salesperson is given directive by management. Go get a 12% price increase. And the seller, with a voice between their ears, will say, "Oh my God, you're killing me, boss. There's no way we can get 12%. They've already decided that they can't get it. They go into the buyer's office and they say, "Hey, I'm here. I got some really bad news. I fought for you, but we're going to need 12% price increase. What do you think about that?" And the buyer will say, "12%, you're out of your mind. Get out of here." And the seller will go back to their boss and they will say, "Hey, I floated that 12% price increase. And the buyer said, no, they're going to replace us if we force them to get 12%. I tried, but they said, no." That's not trying. You know, trying is you go to the buyer and you say, "Hey, listen, I got some bad news. I did the best for you already. It would have been worse. I need 12%. And the buyer is going to say, "Of course, 12%, you're out of your mind. No." And then the seller, if they're trying to negotiate, will say, "Listen, I need to have a serious discussion. If you're not empowered to say yes, I need to talk to somebody who is. Try to get to a decision maker that can do that. If it's not your boss, it's your boss's boss. But make no mistake, I have to have a discussion about this 12%. Now, I may not get 12%, but I got to get some value out of this to take back to my boss. And what I mean by you're not going to get 12%, I could get a 10% increase if you give us another year on the deal, right? So now we're exchanging value in a negotiation process. But to keep trying, and I mentioned the restaurant example, there's a try there. So when I check in, and my wife hates negotiating, by the way, when I check into a new restaurant, and they say, "Hi, would you like the bar or the restaurant or the high top or the booth?" I will say the same thing every time. "I want to sit with your best server." And they'll go, "Huh?" They give me that look like, no one ever asked for that. And I'll say, "You know the server that trains all the other servers. Because if I'm going to pay full price for a meal, and my wife has made it very clear that we're going to pay full price, I'm not allowed to negotiate over food. I want the best experience possible. No disrespect, everyone has to start somewhere, but I don't want to start with the newbie that's their first day on the job because being a server is really hard. I don't want that job. I want somebody who's experienced at it, who knows how to make sure that we have a pleasant experience." Now, the restaurant, the host, will miss the opportunity to negotiate back. What they should say is, "Can you wait 10 minutes? They just got sat. And by the way, if you have a great experience, will you leave us a Google review? Leave us a Yelp review. And now I'm going to produce some value for them, which is a favorable review. And I get value for us, which is a great experience." That's an opportunity to negotiate. So people just miss it because they're not paying attention. So to try more often, I think is a key to become a great negotiator.
All great illustrations. And I love the interweaving of the personal and the business application, because often people get siloed into one or the other. And honestly, the restaurant is a great example of the everyday opportunities that we have. Not too long ago, I think I was in South Florida last year, and it was the typical, I'm hauling back to the airport. I scheduled one too many meetings, traffic, like I'm pulling into the parking garage on two wheels.
Was it Miami?
No, Lauderdale.
Oh, Lauderdale. Okay. Miami's really no fun to get to the airport,
it's terrible.
But Lauderdale.
Hence why I was flying out of Lauderdale. But so I could have gassed the rental car up the night before. I could have. I chose not to. So here I am pulling into the rental car facility with almost half a tank of gas. And now they're going to charge me $27 a gallon or whatever it is to refill. Mm-hmm. So my responsibility, I got it. So I stand up, I get all my stuff out of the car. And as I'm getting up, I realize that I had like a Dunkin' Donuts bag and a bottle of water in the pocket on the door. So I wait for the guy who's going to check me out to come over. And as he's about to step around the door, I go, "Hang on, man, I don't want to be rude. Let me get that for you." And I grab the trash and I go throw it out. So now as I come back, I say to him, like, "Hey, man, this is my fault. I know I should have gassed up the car. I had a meeting run long. I'm scrambling to make my airplane. If there's anything you could do to help me out on the gas, I would be grateful." He's like, "Well, let me see." And he looks at the thing, and you know, it's above half. I'm not asking him for a full tank here. He turns around and he goes, "I got you, brother." Then he pulls out a card from his pocket and, to your point, says, "And I would really appreciate it if you could fill out a positive review for me." And as I'm taking that card from him, I had all I could do not to bow and say, "Touché, my friend." And I did.
Right.
When I got back to my office on Monday, I did it for him. He took the opportunity. He saw my attempt and raised. So yeah. What could we do but respect that? When you talk about trying, and you gave the example of the sales guy that went in and did the old, "I did the best I could. I'm going to need 12%. I'm sorry. I can't get it, boss." I wonder, and I would love your opinion on this, how much of that effort is driven by the fact that there is this perceived, in the B2B space, there's this perceived veil of safety. Like, I can say I tried and I can fail because I have this company behind me that makes a bunch of money and they have other clients and they'll figure it out and I'll still have my job. But if I needed that 12% to feed my family or to do something very personal for me, now that level of effort would likely be much different. So I guess a two-part question. Number one, just your overall thoughts on that safety impacting the amount of effort. And then as an educator, how do we help people bridge that gap so they do put in more effort?
Well, you nailed it. Here's what happens. I've got several examples of this. You got to be careful with confidentiality agreements, but I'll be generic in nature. If the comp plan is revenue-based, you'll see a lot of deals come in at the bottom line. Because even though finance won't tell salespeople where the bottom line is, and that really frustrates salespeople, why won't they tell me where the bottom line is? Because you haven't earned the trust to know where the bottom line is. I told that story, and two salespeople said, "We know what the bottom lines are." And I said, "Come on, you don't know where the bottom lines are." They said, no, we do. We work with finance. And I said, "Well, how come you have access to the bottom lines?" And they told me this negotiation story where finance had created a spreadsheet and had hid some columns with the real bottom line to do the right calculations. And these two guys saw that the columns were like A, B, C, D, F. Wait a minute, where's E? And they unhid it. So they found this information. They had a discussion with finance. They came back. They delivered a deal closer to their opening position, where they started the negotiation, market price. And finance said, "Woof. You knew the bottom lines. Thanks for not going there. How'd you do it?" And the sales guy said, "We didn't have to. We were selling premium products and services, and we expect a premium return." So that's a unique story. That's a unicorn. Most salespeople aren't trusted to have the bottom lines because of that safety factor. See, if you go to your bottom line, it's the best we can do. Take it or leave it. Now, if the buyer decides to not award them the business at the bottom line, a salesperson can go back to their boss and say, "We're too high, boss. Wasn't me. It wasn't my ability. I tried really hard. We were really assertive on pricing. So it must be our pricing model, our suppliers, finance. It's someone else's fault. They like me. They didn't like the price," versus trying to get a high price, a premium, and sell your value and trade concessions maybe on something else besides price. Now, all of a sudden, if you don't win the deal, it might have been, "Oh, I could have been a little more aggressive." Oh, and they lose an opportunity on that. Now, when comp plans are based on margin, you'll see salespeople trying harder to get more margin for the company. So it really needs to be based on that. But that's hard to do too. You know, some margin is better than no margin. You'll hear a lot of salespeople say that. So even then, salespeople are thinking about discounting right away. Now, I spent 3 years in sales and 14 years in purchasing. Because of that order, as a purchasing person, I know what's going on between the ears of most salespeople most of the time. So I can use that to my advantage to create leverage with the salesperson. If I know they're already thinking about discounting when we're negotiating, I have an advantage. So I would say the comp plan is really important. Design it well to incent people. I did have a lady in the hotel industry selling products and services into hotels, of which I spent a lot of time on the buy side. And it came up, if a buyer says, I need you to be at this price, here's where I need you to be. What do you do, Mike? And she said, I have an example that's going on right now. I have an answer that I gave. And I said, let's hear your answer. And she said, here's what I tell them. Do you want me to miss my mortgage payment? Because at that price, I'm not going to make my sales plan. I'm going to be short this month, and I'm not going to be able to put a roof over my head. So now she's taking this business situation. She's removing her company, removing their company, and she's making it personal with the buyer. Do you want me to miss my mortgage payment? And I thought, wow, that's a really sophisticated emotional play on what could be a non-emotional business-to-business situation. All right, did that answer your question?
It does. Oh, it definitely does. And that's the beauty of the conversation. The comp plan, it kind of separates the strategic from the personal, because we all tend to do what we're incentivized to do. Whether I don't do a good job incentivizing myself. I'm losing my vocabulary. Yeah. So a lot of times those external incentives become important. So it's like that peer-to-peer motivation. If you and I were, you know, talking to each other all the time and you're working to help me hold myself accountable, I'm going to do a much better job than holding myself accountable. Like, just in transparency, that's the way my personality is. Other people, they're going to hold themselves accountable a lot better. So the comp plan can certainly do a lot to help incentivize people in that direction. And then to your point, for every negotiator, we could sit here probably for hours and start listing out best practices. If this, then that, say this, don't say that, plan this way, don't focus on that. But the reality is, once we get into the conversations, our personalities come into play. Our vocabularies come into play. Our methods of building relationships come into play. And so being able to personalize that in a way that works for us, which is an example of the woman you just gave, that has to be there for all of us. So I don't know about you, but for me, one of the things that can be frustrating when leading a education session is when you can tell at least some person is sitting there just waiting for the one thing I need to say every time, and then I'll be successful. Like, brother, if that existed, we'd be having this conversation on my private island. we can give alternatives, but if we don't understand, theory is not the right word, but if we don't understand how and why something works in the context of how and why it works, then we won't be able to ad lib or adjust on the fly. We joked winging it earlier. It's not winging it, but we won't be able to adapt the strategy on the fly to be successful in those moments.
I love everything you said. I've read advice. I try to be a lifelong learner. I'm learning the craft while I'm teaching the craft. And every once in a while, I'll see an article, and there's one very famous person that I don't want to mention their name, because they get in trouble when I poke bears sometimes. They don't like to be poked, and we end up this internet debate. But they said 100% success rate closing deals with these four techniques. And I'm like, well, first of all, every student in high school knows anytime something says always or never, then it's probably not that answer. There are no certainties in life, but it's marketing. So, I'll let them off the hook. But what salespeople, I think, fail to realize is that buyers are paying attention to these same articles. We're all on LinkedIn. We all get the same similar feeds in the algorithm. So when it says, here's the number one sales technique to use, and it's on one of those nice Instagram infographics, buyers are reading that too. So then later that afternoon, because salespeople get right on it, the email comes in with the exact same technique that the buyer just read about in the morning. And then they go, you got to be kidding me. The guy thinks he's going to trick me into responding to this email. And if they didn't read it on LinkedIn, buyers, because they're dealing with multiple suppliers all the time, they start to see these patterns. The third salesperson this week using this particular email open line or something like that. It's like, do you not know that's not my first rodeo? I mean, buyers within the first year start to see these sales patterns, and they get really old especially when they are not authentic. When it's a part of the sales process, it becomes very apparent that it's a process to the buy side. And now we're not building a relationship. In fact, I would argue you're damaging the relationship. I think being authentic, you know, imagine these are all tools. If I was a carpenter and I've got all these tools on my wall, I shouldn't use the same tool all the time. You know, if all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. You build a pretty funny house. So what I tell people is I'm going to tell you about 20 different tools. I'm going to tell you about how I use the tools. I'm going to tell you how the other side perceives using the tools. And then it's up to you to figure out the right way to use the right tool at the right time for you. Because you're different than I am. And then if you're being authentic in using that tool, I think you have a better chance of A, success, and B, building a relationship with the other side where they feel like you're being authentic and truthful with them. Can I give you a real example that just happened?
Please.
So I'm on a different podcast. We're doing pop-up negotiations where we're just practicing techniques. And there's three of us that do it. And in this case, I was the observer watching a technique. And the technique was called mirroring, which is a very famous FBI technique, where you basically repeat some words, a word or some words that the other side says, and see what happens. So this person, Fred, happened to be a lifelong salesperson, and he teaches salespeople. His technique was mirroring. So as the buyer in the situation was negotiating, they said something about sweet and tart. They were buying apples, nondescript. It's a commodity. And Fred says, sweet, tart, sweet, and tart, sweet, and tart. He said it three times. So that was one use of mirroring. Later in there, he asked for a price. And the buyer said, well, you know, $850. And he missed an opportunity to mirror $850. So as we were doing the debrief, the observation, I said, Fred, you're using this mirroring technique, but you're not using it the same way I would have used it. What's going on? And he said, well, I'm building a relationship using mirroring. And I said, explain that further. And he said, well, I'm repeating their words so they know that I heard them. And that's why I'm repeating the words. And I said, so different use of the same tool mirroring from a salesperson versus a purchasing person. Now, here's how I, as a purchasing person, would use that tool. I would say, $850. And make the salesperson then defend why 850 is a number. I'm trying to gain information from the other side. So when a buyer uses mirroring, they're using it to get the seller to reveal more information. When a salesperson uses mirroring, they're trying to build a relationship. Now, that's just one data point and just two people. But I thought it was fascinating how you can take one technique and it's used differently from each side of the table. Does that resonate? Does that make sense?
Oh, it resonates perfectly. And I'm going to dive further down that road in just a minute. To circle back half a second, I feel like a lot of times when people are trying to differentiate themselves in any relationship building process, you can be a seller, you can be a buyer, you can be a hiring manager, you can be a prospective employee, whatever it is, that people generally try to differentiate themselves in a way that turns out to be bragging. So if we do it in selling, you know, our product does this, our company does that, I've been doing it for this long, you know, whatever it is. But in reality, to your point, often, especially in the earliest stages, the best way to differentiate ourselves is to talk to somebody differently than everybody else talks to them. As you just said, a buyer, oftentimes, so pick one. So there's a group I'm working with right now. They do contract renegotiations for their clients. So when we started working with them, you're not just differentiating yourselves from your direct competitors. You got to differentiate yourself from every single other person that's reaching out to your clients to try to get a share of their available wallet. So now how are we creating a conversational experience that is different than everybody else's? And we can do that in a compact time, and you know, it doesn't have to be crazy.
Yeah.
But now, because we're communicating with them different, we are different. We're not telling them we're different. The experience is different. And then it allows for this authentic tool use to begin to create those opportunities for her. So I saw you react. I'll pause there for a second. Then I'd love to get back to this buyer seller.
Yeah. So let's talk about communications. One thing that I say in every single workshop that I do, communications is not what I say. It's what you hear. There's the message I'm trying to get out, but then there's the way you receive it. I think communications, we have to be really respectful of the other side. And I don't like to stereotype, but there are some trends and some patterns, some cultural things that we need to look for. For example, in my purchasing career, I worked with a lot of different internal customers, I'll call them. People that I was sourcing business for a solution they were looking for. IT, marketing, HR, manufacturing, finance. And here's what I shouldn't say learned, but here's what I kind of picked up on and what I would do, technique, to have better relationships internally. I would, when I'm talking to somebody who has a background in finance, engineering, very structured organizations or functions, I would use the word think. I think. Here's what I think. When I would work with somebody in one of the softer skills, in HR, in marketing, I would say, here's what I feel. Now, to me, I'm indifferent. I'm agnostic. Because it's what follows is the important thing for me. But using a word that resonates more likely with people in that profession is my way of leading the conversation. So you get me, right? I get you. I'm trying to get you. So hopefully you'll get me back. And just making that little effort in choosing the right word, working with somebody. One of the things I think I don't have data that says this made me successful. I felt more confident. I felt like I was trying, and I felt like that came across when I was working with somebody else.
I think you're on the right track there. I don't have the science behind it either. But that's one that I would vouch for. And I would say I would continue with that. Not that my opinion matters, by the way. But the logic behind it and the application, I think, is consistent. And to your point, the word choice does make a difference. And often we can do a much better job making somebody feel like we heard them and that we're experiencing them and that we're part of this mutual relationship of the moment with our strategic word choice than just repeating something they said three times. Like, yeah. There's better opportunities there. But I was fascinated with your example of using the mirroring from the buyer side versus the seller side. And I know that from some of the work that you do talk a lot about kind of the differences and similarities, having been on both sides of the table. So I would love it if you could talk a little bit about how a buyer might perceive the situation. Well, let me ask that question better. Yeah. Often when we have these conversations, somebody is speaking specifically about the sellers from the seller's perspective. This is what we do. Or they're speaking specifically from the buyer's perspective. From the buyer's perspective, this is how we should be engaging in these conversations. From your perspective of being on both sides of the table, you use the mirroring example as one. What would be another one or two examples of similar techniques that can be utilized differently depending on the side of the table that you're on?
Timing can produce leverage on either side. What I see consistently from sales organizations, especially if they're publicly traded companies, is at the end of the month, end of the quarter, end of the year, there will be a discount. You know, let's discount it to move the decision forward on our timeline. So salespeople will use time, and salespeople are under pressure at the end of the month, end of the quarter, end of the year. And under the table, you can't see my knees shaking, but the salespeople, they're really concerned about making their number. And they talk a little faster and their voice goes a little higher and they send those emails. Hey, how are we with that purchase order? You know, and they, that's the buyer speak in my head. When a salesperson says, hey, Mike, how are we coming with that purchase order? I'm making this crazy high-pitched voice. Because I know the salesperson is under some pressure. Their boss said, hey, get that across the finish line. So I got time on my side. And by the way, when a salesperson says we can give you a 12% discount if we can get the order in this year, I as a buyer go, thank you for that knowledge. I know I can get that 12% next year.
Thank you. Amen.
Right. So you think that you're going to make me speed up, you're not.
No.
Now, if it meets my timeline, and I'll talk about that in a second, then sure, I'll take the 12% now because it's easy. The 12% next year is harder to get. I may have to, you know, look at you a little more sternly. I may have to use some FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt techniques to go back and get that 12. You know I can get it. You go check with your boss, go check with your boss's boss. Now, here's what salespeople don't know about purchasing people and time. Been in hundreds of decision committee meetings where this identical thing happens. The decision will get made. Go with Mike Reddington. We're going to give you the business.
Thank you.
And the internal customer really wants to get started because once the decision is made, you know, it's purchasing has added time to this. They've added a month. They've added 3 months because of we have to have 8 suppliers or minimum of 3, and we have to have an RFP process, and we have to be fair. We have to give the suppliers time. Meanwhile, the internal customer has just wanted to get their solution in place. Once a decision made, they tell purchasing, okay, now go award the business. And purchasing says, well, hold on a second here. I got to negotiate this deal now. And the end user community will say, well, Mike, come on, I know you're trying to save some money here, but let's go. And I say, no, it's not just the money. We're trying to produce value. A good purchasing person is always looking at value, not just price. But I need a couple of days here. And they go, fine, you can have 3 days, but let's get going because I got a timeline I got to meet. The person says, yeah, listen, just hold, I got this. Don't tell them they have the business. Then they'll call the supplier and they'll say, hey, Mike, listen, I'm getting together with the committee. There's a lot of good, talk about you, but there's a couple of failures, some things we need to work on in your proposal. We're not quite there yet. Listen, Mike, here's what I need. I need an improved timeline. I need to speed things up, slow things down, whatever it might be. I need for you to give me your A team. Met a lot of people at your organization through the process, but there's 3 or 4 that really stood out. So I'm going to need for them to be assigned to this. And listen, this pricing, I mean, I love that you're trying there, but there's no way that that's a reasonable price. So I'm going to need you to reduce your price. Under the table, my knees are shaking because I know the decision's already been made. And I know my internal community might be calling you and saying, hey, congratulations, by the way, Mike's going to be calling you and trying to get a better deal, right? And you're saying, hey, Mike, well, listen, I'm going to need a couple of days on this. Now I go, I can't go a couple of days. Come on, Mike, we got to get this in place. I got to play cool. Hey, Mike, listen, I thought you knew your business well. Because somebody who knows their business can make these decisions fairly quickly. Well, and then you might say, well, Mike, I could make these decisions, but it's really not up to me. It's up to my boss. I got to check with some people. And now I have to use a little tactic. I have to say, check with your boss. Mike, I thought I was negotiating with the person who had authority here. So if it's not you, no disrespect, but I'm going to need to talk to your boss. Are they available this afternoon? So I've got time pressure on me, but I can't let you, the seller, see it. Because as soon as you know that I'm going, hey, Mike, listen, can you come in here? Let's negotiate this deal today. Let's get this across the finish line. The voice in your head will start saying, oh, Mike really is desperate to get this order placed. Maybe I don't have to give as much. Maybe I can ask for more things in return. So there's this little dance that buyers and sellers play around how much time they have and the timing of when the award is going to be made that can produce leverage for both sides. Does that answer the question on another technique?
It does. That's a great example, not only on how it can be different from each side, but also how that the paradigm shifts throughout the conversation, or throughout the process, excuse me, that it might be more in somebody's favor at one end than in somebody else's favor at the other end, and understanding that shift. I think that's a really great way to look at it, especially the little peek behind the scenes on the buying side that, yeah, okay, this is who we're going to go with, but now I've got my job to do.
And got my job to do.
On both sides, and here's what I've found to be, and I would love your input on this, part of the trickiness of it, and even reflected with some of like the questions and things that you offered in the example, is that the negotiators tie their self-image to their part in the process. So on the buying side, yes, it's I need to go negotiate the deal, but it's also like, I got to go negotiate this deal. Because now that they want to do it fast, and I told them they got to wait for me, I got to come back with some cool stuff for them. And so now, because we attached our self-image to this, it's no longer a B2B transaction. It's Mike versus Mike. Now
there's
this whole new dynamic because we've now taken our eye off the ball. the ball is to get this new solution out of, we want to get it at a valuable rate, the value of the entire deal. It's got to be there. But we want to bring this new valuable solution along with hopefully a positive, sustainable relationship to our internal end user. That's the ball. But now when it's our turn, it's like, oh, let me be the hero. And now that we get our self-image involved, we lose that and start creating more additional hurdles that don't necessarily have to be there.
I love that you picked up on that. I don't think I think about that often enough. You're absolutely right. There is the ego of the negotiator in front of your internal customers who you've just told to wait for 3 days. Let me take this, see what I can do. Because now you have to produce some value going back. I do think that's very strong in there. And there is a competitive nature. I see a lot about collaboration. Collaboration is a wonderful thing. There's a ton of value in collaborating, but make no mistake. After you're done collaborating and growing the pie, making the deal as big as possible, there's a competitive nature, which is both individual, me against you. It's company against company. There's so many dynamics that go into how do I get value so that I can show my boss that on my goals and objectives. I have a raise and a promotion that I'm trying to get. And the more value I can bring back, the more likely it is I'll get more responsibility in some way, shape, or form. While you on the other side, you're trying to hit, as a salesperson, you're trying to hit your goals for the quarter. You're trying to get a raise too. You're trying to get a promotion too. So there is a competitive nature to negotiating, even in collaborative negotiations. We can almost compete to collaborate. Let's the two of us get together and throw all sorts of creative things. We can make the deal a longer-term deal. We can change specifications. We can change the delivery date. Should we use your freight provider or my freight provider? What else could we do? Payment terms. Your interest rate versus my interest rate. The cost to borrow. There's a ton of stuff that can go into a deal that you can collaborate on. Who's got the better? But if your interest rate is 7% and my interest rate to borrow is 5%, so we should borrow at 5%. How do we split up that two? Do I get to keep it because it's my rate? Do I get to keep it because I'm the buyer? Do we split it a point to point? Well, that's just a math equation. So there's this collaboration that can go on, but then there's the competitive side that I think is very natural in life. And I do think competition is a good thing, as long as it's driving the right behaviors and not negative behaviors.
Yeah, which is all the delicate balance for all of us. But then also recognizing in the conversation that if we do identify that somebody, whether we identify it or not, almost to a degree, assuming that somebody else is being competitive, like their self-image is attached to this, oftentimes the riddle becomes, how do we help them save face in our responses? So you're giving me all of this. Well, I'm going to need your A team. I'm going to need a price discount. I'm going to need to speed up the timeline. And how come you can't make the decision? I thought you were the man. You're telling me you're not the man. What's the matter, man? I thought I was dealing with the guy. And so now this pressure you're trying to put on me. Okay, cool. You know, it's how the game is played. That's fine. But now the problem I really need to solve isn't defending myself and my ego. The problem I really need to solve is give you a face-saving reason to go back to your business and say, well, they sped up the timeline, but we're going to get who they get, and the price is the price.
But at least we got an improved timeline.
Exactly. And so creating those face-saving opportunities.
It's even the way. So for example, if you ask me for a, let's say you ask me for a discount. Let's say you ask me for improved timing, improved team. Doesn't matter what you ask me for. You're the buyer, I'm the seller. And I say, because I've heard that I already have the order, you know, my sources, I went backdoor selling. And I say, no, Mike, that's not going to happen. Okay, I'm almost arrogant about it, right? Mm-hmm. Now you're going to feel like, oh yeah? Now, different way of saying it. I could say, you need improved pricing, improved team, and improved delivery date. Okay, I'm be straight up transparent. We were assertive going in. I don't want to lose on any of those, so I'm going to go check with our team. I need about 10 minutes. Let me see if anybody has any ideas. And I come back and I say, I got bad news, Mike. We were really as assertive as we could be on that proposal. We went all in to win your business. How do you feel now compared to the first time?
Much different.
Right. I listened to you. I mirrored, I repeated your words back. I gave the no a little bit of time, and I made the no a softer no versus an arrogant no. And that respected your feelings, your ego in it, even though the result is identical.
It's the communication of the result, because going back to what you said, it's how you heard the message, not how I delivered the message.
There you go. Well, and even so I was involved in a fairly large negotiation with a printer, R.R. Donnelly. It was a $100 million global print deal. And I'm in this negotiation. Now, had they been paying attention to the clues, we'd already decided to give them the business. When I say paying attention, we brought 10 business leads. They brought 10 print experts. We had a 20-person room down a home shopping network down in Florida. That's a lot of firepower to put in a room if we're not really serious about doing business. So Bob Nelson is the president of R.R. Donnelly, at the time anyway. And Bob was giving a passionate, persuasive speech about why we should award them the business. And in this presentation, he says, and by the way, we've just rolled out a Six Sigma initiative. Now, this is how fast the negotiation went. I stopped him. I said, Bob, when I hear you say Six Sigma, I'm assuming there's a cost savings goal attached to that. And he said, as a matter of fact, there is. And I said, is it 6%? Which is a standard benchmark number. And I said, is it 6%? Is that your goal? And he said, yeah, we're trying to save about 6% a year. And I said, I want half of that back every year in a rebate. And he said, done. 6% on $100 million is $6 million. He just gave me $3 million in 15 seconds. My boss was ecstatic. We were giving them the business. We just got $3 million more value. And the voice in my head said, oh, God, I didn't ask for enough. See, Bob, being the president, wanting to make me feel good, wanting to say yes, because yes is a word that makes you feel good, he forgot about my emotional needs in that moment. Had Bob have said, Mike, do you realize you just asked me for $3 million? And I would have said, uh-huh, tried. He would have said, listen, there's nowhere near $3 million baked into our numbers. Out of respect for your position, I'll call our CEO. And I would have said, there's an office across the hall. You can use that. And he would have stepped outside and came back in and said, the CEO is in France. I need until tomorrow morning. And I would have said, for $3 million, you can have until tomorrow morning. And he would have said, Mike, really? Give me a little bit of time. And in the morning, we met at Starbucks because that's what we do. And I would have said, hey, Bob, where's my $3 million? And he would have said, Mike, seriously, we can offer you $500,000 if we stop negotiating now and start to integrate our teams so we can get to that cost savings. And I would have said, $500,000. How about a million? And we would have settled around $750,000. And I would tell the story about how I went all the way to the CEO to get $750,000. And instead, I tell the story about how we got $3 million in 15 seconds. And I'm unsatisfied. You know, I don't want to be greedy, but I'm competitive. Was 6% really 8%? And could we have got 60-40 instead of 50-50? Could I have delivered $4.8 million instead of $3 back to my company? I don't know. What I know is Bob wanted to make me feel good by saying yes. And he ended up leaving an unresolved question in my head. How much more was there? All I'm saying is consider the other side's emotional needs when you say yes or no. Delaying the yes. Hard no versus a softer no. Can all play an impact on the emotional needs of a buyer.
Great example. You probably had to put yourself through a little bit of emotional trauma going back through it and unearthing that unanswered question. So I appreciate
Let me
sacrifice.
Talk about this. Bob and I have had dinner together twice in Vegas. I talked to him online once a year. And the reason I want to say that is, and a lot of the people in my stories, I'm Facebook friends with Bob on Facebook. He's not on there a lot. Paul Lagudi is the president of a supplier in Vegas. I'm friends with these people outside of the negotiation. So negotiations doesn't have to be an I win, you lose. Even when it's tense, you can actually build a relationship through the negotiation process. I didn't say it's simple and I didn't say it's easy. But if you're paying attention, if you negotiate properly, you should have a better relationship because of the negotiation process, not in spite of a negotiation.
I agree entirely. Just from respecting the process itself, how you treat them throughout the process, the respect you show. There's a long time ago, I was doing some leadership training, and there was an attendee. We're in Mississippi, and there was an attendee in the course that started talking about how what we were saying was resonating with him. And in a previous conversation, he told me that he was a minor league baseball player. He had played in the Oakland A's organization. I don't think he ever made it as high as AAA. Maybe he did. But either way, he never made the big leagues. And now here he is in his corporate career. And I said, you know what? I bet that comes from your experience playing minor league baseball. And he kind of looked at me funny. I was like, man, I never made it past high school baseball. So you're going to have to correct me where I'm wrong on this one. But from what I understand, minor league baseball involves a lot of really long, hot, sweaty, miserable bus rides. A lot of terrible meals. A lot of really uncomfortable hotel stays, if you actually get them. Not a lot of money. It's the people that are there generally come from all kinds of different backgrounds. But the thing that unites them is the shared sacrifice. And he kind of sat back and he was like, you're right. So when you go through that negotiation process with somebody, there is that shared experience that you're building together. And now that shared experience becomes the common bond to build the relationship on long term. And all too often, to your point, it's easy to get lost in these immediate emotional needs and let go of these really high potential long term outcomes we have the chance to create.
Yeah, you're dead on. I have a relationship with a guy named Joe Pecoraro in New York. And Joe Peck, he was a CEO of a company called MaterialNet. Joe's an all-in guy. He's the guy, he plays poker, and he's the guy at the table. He's like, I'm all in on this. He's a fantastic business person, too. So I met Joe. We were doing reverse auctions when American Airlines started off as America West Airlines. America West bought United out of bankruptcy and then American Airlines out of bankruptcy. So I was running reverse auctions for them. We had two pilot programs. One was with Free Markets and one was with MaterialNet. And we like MaterialNet better. Through this process, we looked at 20 different reverse auction providers. It was a land grab at that time. And it, almost like AI is right now. And through the process, we kept hearing the same thing from salespeople. Everything is reverse auctionable. Everything is reverse auctionable. As long as you have a spec, you can put the, and you need a price, you can put it in the tool. So I said to one of them, well, are reverse auctions reverse auctionable? And the guy, this awkward pause, and he's like, well, yeah, I guess so. I said, you know, we're going to do a reverse auction for reverse auction providers. So we put all these reverse auction providers in the auction. And in a reverse auction, we said $100,000 for our business, unlimited auctions, 10,000 bid increment. So the first person to bid 100 is in at 100. The next person has to bid 90 or below for this auction for their bid to be accepted. Start at 100. We go to 90, go to 80, 70, 60. Price is going down. We're just, as buyers, we're like, oh my God, we had a $100,000 budget. We're already half our budget. This is amazing. Keep going down, 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 down. Joe Peck comes in. $9,999 is the bid. Now the minimum bid group is 10,000. I get an instant message from Joe. I win. Right? Because he's figured out that the system won't let anybody bid below him. Right? Smart guy. I'm willing to pay him 9,999. No problem. I was willing to pay him 100, but the market took it down. I get another instant message come in through the messenger from another supplier. Mike, the system won't let us bid below 9,999, but we're going to give it to you for free. That is our offer. We're putting it in the system. I DM Joe back. I said, Joe, it's not in the system. You tricked the system. Good for you. I'll give you credit for that, but I've got to offer at free. What are you going to do? Joe messes me back. Mike, I am not going to pay you for the right to do your auctions. I said, no, I'm not asking you to pay us 10 grand. I'm asking, will you match the zero? Joe says, done. So now we get this great auction provider at no. So I did a debrief and I called up and I said, Joe, what the hell were you thinking? And Joe goes, I own you. Imagine that tension. Here's a seller telling the head of purchasing, number two purchasing at the time, I own you. And I said, excuse you? And he goes, you heard me. I'm going to take my marketing dollars, and instead of buying advertising, I'm going to put it toward the team that's going to work on your account. And when I need a reference, when I need someone at a conference, when I need someone to say great things about MaterialNet, you're going to be my front man. And I said, Joe, I am nobody's shill. I want to put that right now. I don't just say nice things about people for the sake of saying nice. You can't buy me. He said, oh, no, I don't have to worry about that. He said, I'm going to put my A-team on your account. You are going to love our services. You're going to rave about it, but you're going to do it when I tell you and where I tell you. And they did. We had an A-team, amazing people. It was so easy for me to say nice things about them. But imagine in that moment when somebody says, I own you. Whew. Now, when I go to the city of Manhattan, I call up Joe. I say, I'm going to be in the city. Let's go to dinner. So even tense moments in a negotiation can produce, because they delivered, because I was so happy with them. But man, for a day there, it was tense. And there was a lot of unresolved issues in my head. Like, am I going to get great services? Thankfully, they delivered. So I never had to, challenge my ethics and do that. But again, it goes back to relationship building.
They're not the easy ones. No, not the easy ones. And also understanding the long-term goal. Like, what are we really trying to achieve here? So someone tells me he owns me. Well, those could be fighting words, or it could be an opportunity for me to further understand what he means. And now it honestly sounds like there's some dual ownership here, because yeah, I'll do that for you, assuming your team delivers. So now if you really want him, if he wanted you as his front man, he's got to deliver in order to do that. So, all egos and word choices aside, keeping that long-term goal in mind is what steers the relationship.
Right. So for the sellers out there, let me tell the story a different way. The salespeople who came in and said, yes, you can have a discount. Yes, you can have a better team. Yes, you can have better delivery. Yes, 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 are not the salespeople that I have relationships with to this day. They were a dime a dozen. You're white noise. If you just come in and just give me everything I asked for without asking for anything in return, there is no opportunity to build a relationship. You're a pushover. I want smart business people. I want to do business with smart business people. When I'm making mistakes, I want people to push back and say, Mike, you don't have to say, Mike, you're an idiot. Although I can take it if I'm doing something wrong. I believe we all need to know if we have spinach on our teeth, the kindest thing we can do is say, hey, Mike, you got spinach on your teeth. Now you don't have to say, ha ha, you got spinach on your teeth. But to pull me aside and say, hey, Mike, this is a mistake. I've seen 12 customers in the past year and a half try this and this won't work. And here's why. I love salespeople who push back and don't just say, yes, we'll do that for you. So that's just the thing. I think building a relationship sometimes requires pushing back on the other side and saying, I don't think that's in your best interest. And then having a good rational reason why.
I agree entirely. And it's the phrase that the kids might still be using these days. I don't know if they're not. It's like that game recognizes game. Like, I see you're doing. This is part of the process. It's how it's supposed to be played. Cool. And so this is going to be the wrong phrase to use 4 minutes after we talked about collaboration, but it's like a worthy adversary. Like, we're in this together. We're on the same level. Let's go ahead and make this happen. I feel like as part of that, there's this whole element of confidence. Having the confidence to try, having the confidence to ask for more, having the confidence to respond, having the confidence to be assertive. And we can talk about, I guess, different ways where that's generated from, but I've seen before that this confidence piece is something that you've written and you've talked about as well. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on helping negotiators on either side of the table develop their confidence as their career continues.
Make no mistake, negotiation is the confidence game. If you can't convince yourself that what you're doing is the right thing, the right way, what you're asking for, that you're going to get it, you have no chance of convincing the other side, at least not a confident person on the other side. Now, if they're not confident, you're not confident, you're going to get this, mediocre deal. But you got to convince yourself. I just did a post on having a BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And when I have a backup plan, when I'm awarding business and I'm looking at Salesforce, but I know HubSpot is out there and they're both functionally very similar, different pricing models that can do different things, a little bit different way. But if I know that if I can't get the deal I want, I'm willing to walk away and go with someone else. Having that confidence, you can stay in that room. You can ask for things. You can expect to get things in that negotiation when you have a really good backup plan. So I think that's the first thing that produces confidence, is knowing that you don't have to do a deal with that person. And then the second thing is having a good plan. It's trying as our foundation rule number one, and I mentioned that, but having a solid negotiation plan, knowing what you want and need, and those are two different things. What are you going to ask for your opening position? Having a target where you'd really like to end up, anywhere between your open and your most favorable and your target is a good deal. You should accept it, keep the deal going. It's friendly. Below your target, you should have your bottom line, your walkaway point, your BATNA, where it's better to take another deal. Okay. And then the deal might start to slow down a little bit. Suddenly, it's not as great of a deal. Now, that may be because you didn't set your target properly. You don't have all the information. But to have that plan going in, what a good deal looks like and what a bad deal looks like, part of your planning process, should produce some courage and confidence. Knowing the other side. Looking them up. I look up everybody on LinkedIn. I do not stalk people, but I consider LinkedIn someone's billboard, right? They are choosing the words. They're choosing the pictures. They're choosing the titles. They're choosing lots of things. If I don't look someone up, aren't I being rude? It's like driving by a billboard and going, I'm not going to pay attention to that, right? If they're going to put the effort in, whether it's 5 minutes or 5 hours, to paint a picture of themselves, I should look it up. It would be discourteous to not do that. At least that's my opinion of it. Now, other people have said, and there's a famous negotiator who said, don't bother looking people up because they're liars, which in principle, I agree with. A lot of people are taking liberties on LinkedIn, other social media for sure.
Sure.
But here's the thing. There's things that you really shouldn't lie about on LinkedIn because they can be background checked when you get that next job. Where you went to university, dates of employment. You're probably not going to lie about what companies you worked at. You're probably not going to, you might stretch the title, change it a little bit, especially for older titles. But if your boss can go on LinkedIn, if you have mislabeled yourself, mistitled yourself in your current occupation, you're going to get in trouble. So for me, it's about finding what's probably truthful, reading between the lines, what are they not saying? And I can build a picture of that person before we go negotiate a deal. Even if it's where they went to university, what their background is. Military service, if I'm negotiating with a military person, my language shifts. I'm a little more formal. Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir, out of the gate until proven otherwise. If I'm negotiating with somebody from a more collective culture, from the Nordic countries, there's a little more we, us talk that comes out of my mouth. But I only get that if I find out somebody who's lived in the Netherlands. And I love to negotiate with people from the Netherlands, stereotyping them. They're a little more direct than other cultures. So I will say to somebody who's had a background from the Netherlands, I will say, allow me to be Dutch. I'm asking for permission to come into your culture to be direct. Now, it doesn't mean I have to be mean. It just means I have to be, you know, brutally honest about the situation. But I wouldn't know that unless I looked them up.
That, yes, on so many levels. I feel like a lot of moments where we find ourselves lacking confidence is because we're not necessarily sure what to say or do next, which is natural. But if we can address as many variables as possible before the conversation starts, then there are going to be fewer moments where I lack the current idea of what to say or do next. And to your point, the proper planning addresses that. One thought on the lying piece. Lie to me all you want. If I look somebody up and they are lying, that is equally as valuable to me as if they are telling me the truth, because now I know how they want to be perceived. And now that I know how they want to be perceived, I can use that to my advantage, whether it is true or not. We could talk for another 2 hours about focusing the the futile journey of focusing on whether somebody is lying at a certain point or not. It doesn't make a difference because whether you lie to me or tell me the truth, I can still use that to get to where I need to go.
I love that you said that. I'm 100%. You're preaching to the gospel. Yeah.
Conversation for another day.
Mike, I would like to have a conversation another day. I've got another meeting that I need to run to, but this has been fascinating and really enjoyable. So if you'd like to have me back on the show some other time, I'd say let's do another session.
I'd love to. Before we go and before we hold you up for that next meeting, for people that listen to this and say, hey, I want to learn more from Mike, where do they need to go to find you and your work?
You go to negotiationtraining.com. That's all we do. The formal is negotiationtraining.com by Tableforce, the name of our company. Send me an email, mike@tableforce.com. Link in with me. I love to connect and learn from new people. I'm out there. Come find me.
Awesome. We'll make sure all those links are in the show notes. Really appreciate you taking the time, sharing all your stories and expertise with us today. Thank you so very much. I look forward to continuing the conversation. Mike, thank you so much for such an engaging conversation. I truly appreciate you taking the time to record our conversation and for all of the tips and techniques that you shared. Thank you very much. I love how you called out that it's important to remember life is not binary. Everything is not always win and lose. And it was great how you shared so many examples on not only how we can apply things professionally, but how we can apply them in our personal lives as well. All of those stories were appreciated. It was also great how you called out how we should stop to think about what other people are feeling and thinking, whether they are feeling or whether they are thinking, and how we can change our verbiage to match theirs accordingly. And also, it was so very important what you said about stopping to consider how what we say isn't always what people hear and vice versa as well. Mike, thank you so much. I truly appreciate your time and conversation. And I hope everybody who listened got just as much out of that conversation as I did. I appreciate you spending the time with us today. Thank you. Of course, before we leave, one more time, we want to thank our sponsors, Humantel. Please head over to humantel.com for your best-in-class online self-paced training for developing the ability to identify what people are likely thinking and feeling and recognizing their emotional shifts immediately through their facial expressions and the context of the situation. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% all of their training. Head over to humantel.com. For the interviewers in the room, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers. View their online resources, networking opportunities, learn their training schedule, both online and in person. And of course, dive into the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. How do you qualify? What does it take to earn the designation? And then what does it mean for your career after? All of that and more over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And please, while you're online, head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn all about the programs that our clients ask us to facilitate for their leadership teams, for their sales teams, for their HR teams, and beyond, as they ask us to teach them the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary to build stronger relationships and encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances and in the face of potential consequences. All that and more at inquasive.com. Thank you all so much for continuing to be here week after week and listening to these conversations. I truly appreciate it. Please take a minute to like the show, subscribe to the show, share the show, and of course, leave your feedback. Let us know what you'd love to hear or see, either more or potentially less of. We'd love to hear your feedback. Thank you all again. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.